But you got a lot of information by being silent and watching. The second house acted like soldiers on unwilling leave. The third revolved around Corona, like two chunks of ice about a golden star. The fourth clustered by the fifth's skirts like ducklings. The fifth necromancer turned out to be a fresh-faced woman in her mid-30s with thick glasses and a mild smile. It looked about as much the part as a farmer's wife. The sixth and seventh were perennially absent, ghosts. The eighth's creepy uncle-creepy nephew duo she saw seldom, but even seldom was more than enough.
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, episode 12, Ambiance. We are very excited to welcome our friend Getty onto the show today. Getty, what has brought you into the fandom? What's your relationship with the Locked Tomb fandom?
Well, one of my best friends insisted a couple years ago on me reading the book and lent me her copy of the book. And then I did not read the book and I returned it to her. And she insisted that I take it back. And then I sat on it for another little while and read the first couple pages a couple times. And I was like, I don't know, it's just not clicking. She's like, look, you're going to have this book as long as it takes for you to read it. So eventually, in one long winter, I did wind up reading the book. And then I was like, ah, yes, this is everything actually now. And my favorite characters are the sixth.
So diving into this wonderful chapter, we have a sixth house skull at the top. This is our first time with the sixth house skull. It has been a week. We've been at Kanan House. And Gideon is continuing to be lonely and grumpy.
And surprisingly very quiet still.
Still quiet, has maintained the vow of silence so far. She feels deeply hated by most of the people at the house. She's not feeling well loved or accepted, except by Magnus in particular.
Well, I wouldn't say that's entirely true. Dulcie's 100% interested in her being her little, how does she say it? Scullion? Yeah, her scullion.
So we're talking about the like decor going down towards the ninth quarters. And it's talking about like, we got spine bones bracketing the door, finger bones attached to thin, nearly invisible wires. Like, Harold spent some time crafting.
He's got a little needle and thread, some fishing like, wire.
This is like the Pinterest girly side of Harrow. Yeah.
Where she makes all her bone stud earrings, you know?
I'm also imagining her like noisily dragging a chair over so she can reach up the high places and just like really determined about it. But like it would have been easier if she had Gideon help her.
She probably got some constructs to help her.
Oh yeah, of course.
What I wonder is, did she build all of these bones from chips that she brought with her, or is she scavenging dead people from Earth?
I feel like she must have a stash of bone stuff. Like, she can kind of replicate a lot of bone matter out of very little, even at this stage in her development as a basic necromancer, right? Like,
yeah,
that's kind of her thing. I mean, it's later on in the chapter, too, where we talk about that.
Yeah, and later on in the chapter as well, it talks about what she's wearing underneath her robes, which includes laced chips of bone.
True story. Yeah, I don't think it ever really establishes it, but I'm curious about what the limits of that replication are, because surely there are some limits.
I get the impression that that limit has a relationship to the taxingness of that necromancy on the necromancer. Like, there's themselves that they're putting into it to extend how much they can get out of it, given that the fact that the blood sweat is more drastic, given how much Harrow extends herself.
I love this completely implausible on its face combination of sentiments that Dulcinea spends 100% of her time on the terraces reading romance novels, but was also very difficult to avoid. Like, in what way was it difficult to avoid the terrace, Gideon? What on earth does that even mean?
Oh, Gideon.
Gideon is adapting, but still starved for actual interaction. There's still this particularly vulnerable part of Gideon that Dulcinea is like, ooh,
can very gay.
Agree with that. Yeah. But Gideon is starting to adapt here. Like, now that she realizes there's like space to train, she's kind of calibrated to the space. Like, she's back in her routine. She's back thinking a bit more clearly like herself. She's less being primed by that restless, anxious energy of kind of being stuck and not moving. And we can see that, you know, she starts to kind of think in a bigger picture, like, what are other people doing? What does this space look like? Her vision of what's going on is starting to expand.
She's going back to fantasizing about the cohort.
Yeah, so she's training heavily and she's imagining this cohort fantasy. God, the line, she had fed her entire life into the meat grinder of hope, absolutely destroys me.
This is the first like taste we get of what the Empire is doing. And from this alone, like this paragraph, this set me off. I was like, okay, hold on. Okay, already we knew that there was like a force that Gideon wanted to join to get off of the Ninth. But this is like, there are other worlds out there that they're invading. They're using necromantic energy to do it. They seem to have some sort of thing going on with the necromancers and the frontline fighters that she's like super into. And there's extensive propaganda around it. Sexy propaganda.
I just have underlined this huge section that's like, in her comic books, necromancers kissed the gloved palms of their frontliner comrades in blessed thanks for all that they did. In the comic books, none of these adepts had heart disease, and a lot of them had necromantically uncharacteristic cleavage. There's this biological fantasy about necromancy as healthy and voluptuous and sexy, and the relationship between violence and power being this like beautiful romantic relationship. This is also really the first sign that Gideon is romantically interested in Harrow, because she's giving us this paragraph about the sexy necromancers kissing the cavalier's hand. And then she's like, I want Harrow to look at me and think I'm good. And it's like, oh, you're into her. You had only said that you hated her so far. This is news.
Just the tiniest bit of Harrow recognizing what she is proud of in herself is like pumping her up.
That paragraph about the photochemical lamps and the recycle water is also core evidence that Gideon's narrative is lying to us, because up till this point, she has told us multiple times Gideon never ran unless she had to. And then she's like, except every day before bed.
Well, I mean, is a jog the same thing as a run to a jock? Is that like an important difference to a jock? I'm not a jock. I don't know.
I don't know either.
Doc, weigh in.
Run means there's some kind of like urgency in point B. Jog is kind of like you're moving your body for a time. Like the what I get out of comparing those two is that Gideon refuses to be compelled to urgency. This is on her own time, on her own pace.
I buy that. I take that difference.
I mean, there's plenty of evidence that Gideon is so full of shit throughout the rest of this. And if this chapter alone is like, oh yeah, I hate this motherfucker. I want her dead. I want her out of my life. My life will be infinitely better once she is out. I am going to throw myself at every obstacle to make sure that I get back to her.
Notice me!
Yeah. Notice me.
I love the idea that Gideon is like, fuck this. Fuck Harrow. I don't care what happened to her. Her body's probably completely in pieces. I wash my hands of the whole situation. And then she has lunch and goes back to looking for her. And
she gives up and resumes the search is what she does.
I love Gideon gave up and resumed the search. She gave up on washing her hands because she had a sandwich and felt a little bit better.
Me too.
Man, that's relatable.
She notices that Harrow is gone because of a lack of change at the microscopic level, which is telling us, even though she's not actually interacting with Harrow, she's closely attending to what Harrow is doing. She's noticing that the bedclothes move and then that they don't move. She notices the clothes in the dirty clothes hamper. She's keeping tabs on Harrow, even though Harrow is literally gone.
there's probably a part of Gideon's mind where she has a task now. And so knowing what the fuck Hera is doing is like, but also like they've lived in proximity to each other for years. And there's a kind of intimacy that forms out of that. You know, some parts of people's intimate rhythm, like knowing about, we were theorizing where Hera might sleep in general back on the 9th, like literally at her desk.
So in this moment, Gideon gives us this lovely logical breakdown of how she's interpreting Hera being missing. She gives this literally numbered list with sub numbers. Hera had been prevented from coming home for reasons, e.g. that she was dead, she was too impaired, or she was busy. 2, Hera had chosen to live elsewhere, leaving Gideon free to put her shoes on Hera's bed and indiscriminately riffle through all her things. Or 3, Hera had run away. And the next several paragraphs are her unpacking and weighing each of these options.
I love that the worst thing she can imagine doing to Hera's stuff is buttoning it all up by one button off.
That passage is actually why my Hera blouse has buttons.
Oh, that's delightful.
This also, this passage gives us a really lovely projection. Did you just find it?
Oh my God, I didn't notice that when I was rereading. If it was murder, what if the murderer was like weird, which would make their subsequent marriage to Gideon pretty awkward? Maybe they could just swap friendship bracelets. Oh my fucking God.
Oh boy.
Then what the fuck?
Yeah.
Okay, I am not fully clear on what you two are alluding to in terms of what this reference is. I can kind of feel it, but unpack this for me, please.
One of the things that Nona notices in the, like, Kiriona and Ianthi interacting is that they're wearing matching friendship bracelets.
Oh.
Which also, we're going to have to come back to that, because what does that say about how Kiriona understands the relationship between Hera and Ianthi?
Nervous laughter.
Now, also, there's going to be a wedding in Alecto. That'll be interesting.
Oh my God. She had never seen Hera Harkonnen and Jessamyss's naked face. Kind of sad.
That blew my mind, because I started thinking, I'm like, how early on did Hera independently start following this? So, you know, there was a point in Hera's life where she made a choice.
They must have been putting the skull paint on her as a baby, because Gideon's older.
Yeah, that's true.
So the fact that Gideon hadn't seen her naked face ever.
I'll argue that there wasn't a point where Hera got to make that choice. The only point in which she gets to make that choice is in the pool.
Yeah, yeah. I think about this in a technical thing. In my day-to-day work, I apply sunscreen to small children a lot. So like the experience of having sunscreen applied to you is one you have to learn. Just looking at different stages of early childhood development responding to that, like, is really curious to me. Like, who is the person applying this skull paint to a newborn infant? Is it immediately as Hera was born, she gets painted so that she's never, like,
I kind of wonder if doing the skull paint on the baby isn't a little bit of sort of memento mori for Hera's parents, sort of a way that they're quietly self-flagellating.
For the mass death that was the source of Hera's life. Got it. Yeah, yeah. So I guess the question is, would this be an anomaly compared to, let's say, how her parents were raised?
I would guess, just on a practical level, trying to maintain face paint on a baby doesn't sound like a thing that a community would do as a standard way of handling a baby.
Yeah,
like, babies are already so much work and they already throw up all the time and they're so sticky. I mean, I don't know what that ratio of caregivers to creche babies was, but even if it was 3-1, I personally would not want to try to have 1 3-year-old keep face paint on all the time. That already sounds like way too much work. But if I had a 3-1 ratio, which is a great ratio generally, adding face paint makes that math stop working.
Interestingly enough, if you think about the timing, so these 200 children that died, it said that they were all in a creche together. So like a collective child rearing space. And I would assume there were individuals who specifically were skilled in maintaining and facilitating and teaching and caring in that space, who would then have nothing to do once all those children were dead. So there's the possibility of a dynamic shifting where now there are no children and a bunch of carers.
Think of like other situations in which face painting is part of kind of an intensive socialization process. And like, what age does that start?
Usually, from my understanding, usually it's a coming of age thing. Like you don't have it until you have reached like an adolescence where you are becoming like a recognized member of the community with responsibility.
But we know that it happened before that on the 9th because Gideon talks about getting to stop painting her face. Was it like age 10, age 12 or something? So she was clearly doing it prior to like, you know, coming of age, but we don't know when it started.
Yeah. I think that this statue is John.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And I think Pro defaced it.
Mm. I had originally thought that this was a statue of Kithareia for some reason, which it's not like there's statues of all the other lictors, so I don't know why that would make sense. But the fact that the arms had been lopped off made me then be like, wait, what? And I looked up like famous statues with the head and arm, like, is this just a famous piece of art that John has stolen? And I don't think so, because like the ones that came up had other really notable features, like Winged Victory has the head and arms lopped off. But really, you would mention the wings.
Was left only a torso with beseeching stumps.
The beseeching stumps were also a really interesting detail. There was like a Venus statue that has no head and no arms, but the stumps did not seem to be beseeching in any notable way.
There's Venus a lot of Milo.
Yeah.
She really only has one stump and then a shoulder.
And there's this awareness that Gideon has that this is a lobby. This is a central space. This is a receiving space. So like, I can't imagine who is most likely to be elevated and recognized in that, but John.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Though it is a little confusing, because how would that matter to everybody else if they've never met the guy?
Yeah, why deface a statue of God?
I mean, spite.
Why is there the pit? Why is there the big armored door? What is going on?
Is this big armored hatch to keep something in or to keep something out?
Based on teacher's reaction, it definitely seems like it's a keep something in situation.
So if we needed to build a facility that could contain a bunch of dangerous stuff while it was being actively used, and they were researching resurrection stuff and lictorhood stuff, you know, we get a monster down the road, but like one monster does not an entire secure facility justify.
I also don't think that's the thing you're scared of. The monster is Cytherea's like hunter.
Yeah. Construct. What were they keeping in there? We talked in a previous episode about Gideon's interpretation of hearing voices from a distance. This passage, I feel like, confirms some of our interpretations of that, where the dialogue from the third was ambiguous. And I feel like this is Gideon revising that strategy to try and get more information. She's been practicing eavesdropping. She's noticed that this is a way to get information, and she's developing her skill at it.
Yeah.
Because now she's actively theorizing more details about who the speaker is.
I think it's really interesting that Gideon expresses so much non-confidence about their genders, that the cam voice is probably female and the pal voice is probably male. And I wonder if this is something about the way gender works in this universe, or something about Cam and Pal being a little bit
pretty. I love these two.
This exchange is pointing us to the idea that things about the building are not adding up, that things that should be old are not as old as they should be, or things that should be young are not as young as they should be. And we don't actually know what they're pointing at when they say this. So we get this like overheard, this is supposed to be 3,000 years older than this. And it's like, yeah, but what is that? she's holding the statue chunk. Is that relevant? And I don't know. It does tell us that the statue was not imported into Kanan House already broken, that isn't a feature of the statue, like, as it was recovered from some museum or something. That suggests that it was just broken, or at least it was broken here. Also, Palamity speaks Latin to make interjections. What a fucking nerd.
What does fiat lux mean?
It means let there be light.
Fucking dork.
They're both such dweebs. Like,
they're
and I
dweebs.
I love this part where it's like they've been like, it's not banter, it's not bicker, it's like there's this a little bit of playfulness, but it's also very collaborative exploration. Like, you can tell that Cam has been helping Palamedes process his theories and concepts for a long time, to the point where she can do it both constructively and like a little bit like
They're thinking together. Yeah.
They're thinking together. And we've got a little picture of Cam's sense of humor here, too.
Yeah.
I want to throw this out. Cam Pal is Griddlehark good ending.
Yeah.
Soft. Every time I see their interactions now, I look at this like deep level of trust and commitment that they have towards each other. And seeing it at this deeper level of like their understanding of each other is beyond what anyone else can really conceive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're so already this indivisible unit, just mentally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cam knows all sorts of details about Palamedes' history and developing as a necromancer.
And he knows her as well. When there's this moment, stop that, I need you listening, not racking your brain for rare negatives. He's like, hey, I get that you're playing a game, and I need you to stop doing that. So, like, he gets her, and he can see inside her head. He knows why she's doing what she's doing. And he doesn't manipulate her. He just tells her what he needs in a way that Harrowhark Notogesimus could never.
Harrowhark Notogesimus could never. I really enjoy Cam's statement of swords don't lie, and Hal's response of, but they don't tell the truth either.
Mm-hmm.
And so my brain is like, swords don't lie, I understand Cam's thing as a sword fighter, I get it, but I actually don't as much understand Pal's response.
Well, I mean, they don't tell you anything, they just cut. Swords just cut. They do the violence thing.
I think the thing that tells us is that Pal can't read a sword.
Mm.
I think this is confusing to Claire and I, because they do. They do. But he doesn't understand the language. We know that he is ignorant about sword fighting and about learning sword fighting. That's indicated to us later. In the way that Gideon is really attentive and understands necromancy, the same thing happening for Pal with respect to sword fighting. He knows enough about social strategy to make good decisions about how to use Camilla. But in terms of an actual sword fight, I don't think he can read a fight.
Pal cannot read a sword fight, but Pal is a strategist. Because later down the road, he understands the element of a critical fight enough that he can get an almost unbelievably hard to get advantage on Kithareya.
I'm now distracted by reading a description of these two. Cam was restless as a bird, stepping from one foot to the other, quirking her elbows, rocking from the balls of her feet to the heel.
The fidgetiness of Cam and the stillness of Pal is part of how Nona recognizes them when they are both living in Cam.
And then they immediately notice her. Like, she takes one step too far and they both go, oh, threat.
Oh boy, do I love what happens next.
Yeah.
This is a good fight.
Boy. Oh boy, oh boy.
My favorite fight in the book is these two going at each other.
Gideon is thrilled.
Yes.
Thrilled. Yes. And there is, I understand this, when you don't know who you're going to fight and suddenly you're like, oh shit, I really don't know who I'm fighting. And suddenly you are drawing on yourself in this spontaneous, creative, dance that's like so adrenalized, and there, this is probably the most satisfying thing that's happened to Gideon since she got here.
I love the use of italics in the print edition to express like disbelief.
What the fuck? Yeah.
Her opponent dropped as though shot. Crouch kicked her dagger up into her hand and did a handspring backward down this. Like, the italics are glorious.
So I'm getting very River Tam kind of movement visually.
Yeah,
from this.
I imagine her extremely fluid. She's obviously very acrobatic, and she's just going. Pal did not tell her to go. She made a judgment and swept into action. She's operating autonomously, again, in a way that Hera Harp Notogesimus could never.
I think it's cool the way they describe how Gideon, like, comes into engaging this, like, slips her hand into the knuckle knives. Like, it kind of tells you a little bit about how she's set up her equipment.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that's really interesting to me as a cosplayer and as a fighter. To draw a rapier and to put on your knuckle knives at the same time, if you're a right-handed fighter, both of those are on your left side.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be a big thing, or else it would make drawing the rapier a lot more likely to get all bungled up together.
Gideon leans on her physical strength a lot in this fight. She's described as like catching and throwing Cam's hand into the wall, breaking panels, the detailing, descending like an avenging necro saint. Like,
hot,
so hot. And I'm just like seeing, like, you know, their blades like engaging and pushing, and like beads of sweat coming down. Like, they're focused on interacting with each other through the weapons. They're not like reading each other's faces at all. They don't care about what's going on in their face.
When she hits and she presses and she's pushing down and trying to regain her balance and push and like turn the fight, this is where Gideon like actually makes the big contact. Cav and Gray's eyes were only mildly surprised. And then Al intervenes.
Cam's chilling.
Yeah.
She's like, ooh, interesting.
So it's at that final pause that their awareness starts to recognize a person, not just a fight.
I think it's really, really fascinating that the thing that Pal says to Cam to sort of explain the ceasefire is it's the other one. Like, he is imagining that Camilla thought this was Harrow and went to fucking kill her. So, like, what has Harrow been doing? But, like, why is Cam on site with Harrow at this moment?
There's so many moments in this where we look at these characters and we're like, what if things were nice for you and you could just hang out?
They need to be besties. It's unfair and unfortunate that they're never besties. What the fuck?
I love that so many people respond to them, like, in a make them kiss way. And we're
I
like,
do that.
Make them go bowling.
I want Gideon and Cam to go bowling, and Harrow and Pal to be sitting back there commenting on their bowling. Like a double date. I don't know. It's
I also can see like Cam and Gideon like working out together and kind of venting about the quirks of their necros.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, you know, weird polyamory situations.
Okay. I just had a moment here that I'm hoping I'm right about, but I want to share. So have you ever seen the original Ghost in the Shell?
No. Yes.
So yanked so hard on the top of the hatch that damn near broke her wrists. Do you remember Motoko like pulling open something and basically destroying
like
her
tank?
Body? I think it was a tank. I think she was trying to access the driver of a tank.
Yeah, it like rips up. Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
And that's what I'm getting from here, which is sick.
This reminds me of congenital insensitivity to pain, where some people, it's a very rare condition, some people can't perceive pain. And it's from birth. And so people who have never in their life been able to perceive pain have a really hard time learning to inhibit their behaviors in ways that protect them from harm. And I'm thinking about the ways in which Gideon has learned that damage to her body doesn't mean that much. And I'm thinking that in a really similar way to someone with CIP, she might just be pulling harder than other people. Like she might be putting her body through this damage because she just like doesn't care. She can feel it. It just doesn't matter to her.
Cavaliers.
So Palamedes takes the time to explain what he thinks has happened down there to Gideon. Gideon's in hero mode and doesn't really pay attention, but Palamedes like assumes that she could comprehend what is being described. He recognizes her as someone with knowledge and competency about necromancy.
I think this really illustrates how he relates to Cam as well. Like he assumes Gideon is an intellectual peer who is involved in problem solving. And he's very much like, I don't know why you haven't solved this problem already, but like, okay, like willing to help now that you're ready to fucking take this seriously.
He calls her a simpleton and then goes through this description. I honestly read this as him kind of being generous and kind with somebody that he doesn't understand yet.
In fairness, she is trying to solve a locked door problem by pulling more harder.
Hey,
and
true.
So I think him being like, you fucking dumbass, yeah, is not like hostile so much situationally relevant.
It is very much.
And like Cam and Pal were just sort of needling each other playfully, and so it's very easy to read his comments like, you're winners, you and Nona Jessamis both, as kind-hearted rather than, you know, mean.
Yeah. And then Gideon speaks.
Gideon speaks. She
and he relaxes.
Yeah, he loves that solution. She has come to the end of being able to solve her problems while also upholding her vow of silence, and saving Harrow's life is worth disobeying Harrow about.
Okay, the pit.
It says it took a full minute to descend. That's a long time.
It's a long time to climb a ladder.
That's a long drop.
It is.
Because like, okay, imagining 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, right? So we've got it like six, somewhere around 60 runs?
Yeah, at least 50 meters.
Yeah.
Well, a meter is longer. I don't know. It's like, it's a long way.
A study found that it takes about 5 seconds for a fit person to climb a 10-foot ladder.
Oh, okay. So
it's like 120 feet, which is about 37 meters.
Good way to get hurt if you slip.
Get pushed.
The facility.
Yeah, this is our first time in the facility.
You got these hexagonal tunnels.
It's all like steel grills and weird light. It's like greenish.
I really love how Gideon notes that the only human normal touch here is a ancient prayer bundle of bones. It's very, that's what's normal. That's what's normal to the ninth. That's home.
The thing that is written on the whiteboard is a reference to Jesus's statement on the cross.
It is finished.
It is finished.
And then he dies. In my experience, that statement is often punctuated with a period. This one has an exclamation mark, which seems like a distinct difference.
When it was originally written, punctuation hadn't been invented yet.
Hey, time.
This is the core of Cannon House, whatever this place is.
It's so interesting that this is how we're introduced to it, because it's almost difficult to connect with the scene, because almost immediately we're given there is blood. And like, as a reader, you're so like, I have to figure out, like, I have to know whether Harrow is dead or not. Like, I just have to know. It almost feels hard to connect, which I feel like captures Gideon's experience. Like, she is noticing things, but she's also very single-minded. So Harrow is in a bone in a basement.
S, not broken, importantly.
Why this did not feel clear to me. Why is all the blood on the outside of Harrow Hark known as Jesmus?
good question. Palamedes mentions that she's just like exhausted. Why is all of her blood outside of her, though?
Yeah, he says blood loss not from outside injury.
So it means to me that she has extended her necromancy so far that her blood sweat has caused meaningful blood loss.
There's like pools of blood.
It is a lot of blood. Like, we know Hera is willing to use her own bones in her necromancy, but she doesn't know blood stuff.
No, and she's, like, prejudiced against it.
The only other thing we've had so far about Hera's blood is blood sweat. I do really quite like this introduction of, like, necromancy as a non-antagonistic tool.
It does seem like there's some confusion about it, because Gideon is like, oh, this is necromancy. And he's like, oh, gross. Can you imagine medical necromancy? And, like, it sounds like medical necromancy is the only kind of medical there is on the knife.
Yeah.
And so he's like, why would you use necromancy for that? And she's like, why, what? Yeah, no, me too. Yeah, me too.
Pal specifies that it's curative science.
This starts to kind of show us, like, the larger technology that necromancy exists within, because it's still this interfacing with the body. So either there's, like, this larger body of scientific technology that necromancy is kind of also considered under, or there are more than one type of kind of extraordinary magic-like technologies have been developed.
Gideon is really, really exerting herself to get Harrow back home.
I forget how short a time they really spend in the facility this first time.
Mm-hmm.
Gideon is really extending herself, but also simultaneously still engaging with, like, her hate affection.
Yeah.
She's like, how much can I injure Harrow on the way back? And she's like, she's you know, she's got Hera up on her shoulder, and she's kind of evaluating and calculating the, like, physical requirements that it's going to get back, because it's a hoof, it's a bit. She took a while to get here, and while Hera was quite small, it's not insignificant. But, like, she can't do that without being like, and her head could hit there, and her head could hit there, and her, like, which she doesn't do.
She's also like, I need to really lock in the memory of what it feels like to hold Hera's body so that I can imagine throwing her off a cliff.
Yeah, dude, sure, man. Yeah, totally.
Also, can we talk about how fucking strong it is to just carry someone up a ladder? Hot.
That's crazy.
Hot. I'm trying to imagine exactly how the positioning works. Like, is Gideon holding Hera with one arm and climbing one with the other? Is, like, there's, like, a fire. Is it a fireman carry? Like,
she's, like, dead weight. She's not helping.
No.
For the shoulder.
No, but, like, how is Gideon keeping her from falling off her back?
Uh-huh.
Because that's probably one arm. So now Gideon is climbing with one arm.
Yeah, she's only climbing with one arm, it seems like.
Hot.
Yeah. She's so fucking strong. She talks about the hundreds of sit-ups she does every day as part of her regular routine. This girl,
honestly,
is jacked.
Totally fitspo. Like, I read these scenes of Gideon training, and I'm like, I gotta get back to the gym.
I have read a critique of this book that's like, oh, she wouldn't have enough protein to build all that muscle. I'm like, I don't give a shit. This girl is jacked, and that's the universal truth of this fucking Gideon, is that she's built as fuck.
Also, the fantastic amount of granularity that the fandom loves getting into, where it's like, not enough protein.
Yeah, yeah. There wouldn't be enough on the ninth. They're only eating turnips and bone meal or whatever.
they have slurry.
Yeah, bags of slurry, baby.
Goo.
It's all good from building.
They got porridge bags.
Got a porridge bag.
Porridge in a sandwich bag.
There's nothing else to do on the ninth besides eat porridge and get jacked.
We're all out of porridge.
If she asks how I knew she was in the library, tell her Cam says she clinks when she walks.
This is more of that playful interaction that Palamedes does, where, like, he knows that would piss Hera off. I think he understands this already.
But yeah. It's also a real gesture of good faith, because he's giving her information about her not being as secret as she thinks she is.
Yeah.
And he could just keep that.
Yes.
And he's saying, like, I'm going to let you make yourself more secret from me if you want to, in order to protect you from other people, because, like, we're buddies maybe a little bit.
Yeah. And it underlines that even more with when Gideon's like, I owe you one. And they're like, no, you don't.
He did it for free, which is interesting. It's interesting that Cam frames it as something he did and not as something they did.
I feel like it's... So Pal wants to develop this relationship with Harrow, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's interested in her on several levels, like the mystery angle and all that stuff. But, like, even starting here, he's like, I want this to be a, like, equal relationship. I don't want to have something over Harrow to start this relationship out of her, like, paying attention or actually interacting with me. This is neutral. Like, but I will rub it in. I will rub it in just a little bit because I am the greatest necromancer of my generation. Are you kidding me? Yeah.
That honestly is one of my favorite exchanges in this book. It's just, it endears me to those characters, to and that relationship between Palamedes and Harrow immediately so much.
Yeah.
There is immediately this kind of play competition almost that starts to develop, but also this respect. Like, all of this happens in the same conversation. Mm-hmm. So much of the relationship is established, obviously, in this scene. And Harrow is a participant.
In this scene, we see Cam respond in two very different ways to Harrow. Where at the beginning, it seems like what's happening is she sees Harrow and immediately tries to fight her. But by the end of the scene, it's very clear that she and Pal have had a conversation. Or at the end of the chapter, rather. It's very clear that she and Pal have had a conversation about how they want to be relating to the Ninth. And so she is willing to fight the Ninth, but that's actually not what she prefers. And she knows that that's not what he wants.
There's the bit here where Palamedes says that he doesn't know what's down here. What's the mm-hmm. dangerous thing about that? And honestly, besides teachers, like, warnings later on, I don't think this book tells us much more about what's down there, because I think it has some well of souls on the earth left behind.
Oh, that's
a long run theory that I've got about Nona and, like, the grief well and all the stuff about the river. Ultimately, though, I don't know where Alecto the Ninth is going to take us, but, like, I think we're coming back to Earth and the themes of the river.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
I certainly hope so.
I think it's inevitable.
I really, really want more of how did things end up. This building and its purpose and like how it's evolved over time tells its own story that I really would like to know.
At the end of Nona, they're crossing the sea toward a tower that's coming out of the sea, and I assume that that's Kanan House.
The discrepancy of the dates especially makes it, like, really unclear how John constructed this place or what is and isn't artifice as a part of this whole construction. But I don't know. Lied to on a molecular level. It feels like the experience of reading over Harrow the Ninth.
The disorientation of, like, this reality is not internally consistent.
Gideon and her passed out necromancer part from the Sixth at the top of the facility, and she is looking forward to the long walk back to the Ninth Quarters, bumping Harrow's head all the way.
What an excellent, long-reaching chapter. Like, just the Sixth alone, this extensive, like, introduction to them. They're so distinctive together. I really love them.
Yeah, and another chapter where we learn about people through how they fight.
Yes, good.
Yeah, and such a distinction from the several scenes where Gideon overheard conversations where she actually gets to be part of it.
Yeah.
And such a distinction in how Camilla responds to being eavesdropped on versus Ianthe.
I will say, rereading this chapter for the episode today has made me start to reread the whole book, which
hell yeah.
Has been a long time coming. So I'm going to get to annotate, outline everything Cam ever says in little hearts.
I want to thank you, Getty, for coming here and loving on Camilla and Palamedes with us. Palamedes. I also want to say thank you to everyone who has come with us this far. This has been a fantastic experience, and we continue to look forward to connecting with more people who are really passionate about these characters and about these questions and about this weird fucking building. If you have more theories about this weird building, if you've made a map, like, we have questions. If you have theories, we would like to know them.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was really fun.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Cayley and edited by Han Cayley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art features guest Getty as Yante, photographed by Han. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD.com. Thanks for listening.